beanie, whatever you, whatever they say it is.
How many of you have been asked? There we go. Many of you have been asked that question. So what's your answer? I'm not going to make people answer that. What do you usually say? Just because. Do you say 1 Corinthians 11? Do you say 1 Corinthians 11 is great for a believer who knows their Bible? What do you actually say to people? There are a couple of valid reasons why. First reason is because my church says so. That's not a real great reason, but my church says so is actually a valid reason. In our church covenant, if you want to be a member, women wear veilings. That's a reason. There is something good to I wear of covering because my church says so. There's something good to want to be united with your church. That's good, but that's not quite enough. The second reason, another valid reason, is because the Bible tells us to. 1 Corinthians 11 says that women ought to veil her head when praying or prophesying. That's why. And that's a very good reason. That is simple obedience. Bible says this. God says jump, I jump. God says veil my head, I veil my head. That's a good reason. And I think that it's okay if it stops there, but we can forget the real reason why behind the veiling. The veiling is the headship veiling. Headship is the reason behind the veiling. The veil is a symbol of submission to the headship order. It's not just something I do because the church tells me to, and there is actually a meaning behind it. It's not just God says this, therefore I'm going to do it. There is a meaning behind it. God doesn't just tell you to do random things just to see if you'll do it. He has a reason behind it. So I'd like to... We're going to go to 1 Corinthians 11. We're not going to go far into 1 Corinthians 11. We're basically going to go over one verse, but that is where I'd like to start this morning. So we're going to read 1 Corinthians 11, 2 and 3. We're not going to get into the headship veiling too much today. That's the next sermon. 1 Corinthians 11, 2 and 3. This is Paul speaking to the Corinthian church. Now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the ordinances as I delivered them to you. But I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God. So it sounds like in verse 2, Paul's kind of buttering them up. I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the ordinances as I delivered them unto you. I'm very pleased with you that you remember me and that you listen to me and that you obey me. And then he goes right into it in verse 3. But I'd have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God. He says, but, you're doing great, but you're missing something. The ROM board is talking about a flow chart of what authority should look like. Authorities, Bradford Mennonite Church, ROM board, administrator, principal, house dad, personal workers, teachers. There's an order of authority, and this is God's order of authority. He has God is at the top, then Christ, then man, than woman. Now, I was curious what you would get if you listened to a modern message on 1 Corinthians 11. So I listened to a very evangelical sermon on 1 Corinthians 11 just to see what they would say. I mean, how do you read this from that perspective? Like what's going to come out of this? And he never really got past this point. This point, to put that up there in today's culture is very hard. You want to see someone squirm, watch a video of an evangelical preacher trying to preach that. He said multiple times he is not comfortable with how this seems, how this comes across, how it's written, that man is above woman. That is not okay in today's culture. Women, the feminist movement, that is not what they're saying. Man and women are equal in role and function in everything. And while there's a lot of equality that came because of Christianity, there is a headship order. I was really intrigued about the pressure that man felt. That man felt a tremendous amount of pressure. Like, I don't even feel too much pressure, but he felt a tremendous amount of pressure just saying that women are supposed to submit to men. No matter how many times it was found in the Bible, there's still a lot of pressure there for him. So this can be a charged topic for parts of the Christian world. So why did Paul feel like he needed to remind him of that? Like, this seems pretty elementary. God, Christ, man, woman. Woman's supposed to submit to man. Man's supposed to lead. That's how it is. But Paul had to remind them of this. We're going to go into a little church history of why he had to remind them of this. What was the church of Corinth like? Just a quote. In the Greek and Roman society, women had no opportunity to share the intellectual life of their husbands and fathers and were often treated as mere legal property. Even among the Jews, the husband had control over his wife. In the synagogue, women were segregated from men and had no opportunity to share in the worship services. So women didn't have a tremendous amount of rights back then. Greek or Jew or Gentile alike, there was not very much honor, especially in the public, for women. I've heard multiple times that devout Jewish men used to pray every morning, "Thank you, God, that I am not a Gentile, a woman, or a slave." That's not good company. you, Gentile, woman, or slave. Women were not elevated, that's for sure. Women did not enjoy very many privileges back then. You could say they're at the bottom of the pecking order. In the pecking order of life, women were down there with slaves and Gentiles. That sounds really horrible, but that's reality. I did a little digging on pecking orders. I was studying for a sermon on this farmer's website, and I was looking up pecking orders, and I found a good description of it. Whenever a group of animals lives together, they rely on a system of social hierarchy in order to coexist peacefully, and chickens are no different. Every flock establishes a pecking order, a dominance status amongst individuals in a flock. So for these chickens to live together, they establish a pecking order, and here's who's who. The strongest are at the top, and the ones that are either not as strong or not as aggressive are towards the middle, and the ones that are really stepped on are at the back. And that is established on dominance. Remember that the pecking order is established on dominance. And there was kind of a pecking order back then. The Jews had their pecking order. It was God at the top, then the high priest, then the priests, and now I'm starting to speculate, and then the rich people, and then the poor people, then the women, then the slaves, and I put the Gentiles as dead last because they're pretty low. And the Romans had their pecking order too. They had the emperor up top. I'm going to just leave their gods out of it because emperor was pretty well God. Emperor up top, then they had the politicians and the rich, then the middle class, then the poor, then the slaves and women are about at the same spot on the pecking order. It really was a pecking order. The strongest rose to the top, and the weakest, if they couldn't rise, stayed where they were, and it was pretty well a pecking order. Speaking about the Greek women, the church in Corinth was Greek women. There was a Greek colony. Respectable Greek women were not permitted to leave their house unless accompanied by a male escort. When guests were in the home, the wife was not permitted to eat or interact. She was confined to her quarters. The average Greek woman had the social status of a slave. Girls did not go to school at all. Throughout a woman's entire life, she was not permitted to speak in public. So that's the climate that the Corinthian church was in. That was current. That was not history back then. That was life. Women weren't expected. Women were expected to be silent and not to even be seen. It's not no seen, not heard. It's not even seen, not heard. It's pretty male dominant. The males dominated the pecking order. So that's the climate. And then along comes this Christianity. And contrary to today's thoughts on Christianity and the feminists not liking this idea of women submitting to men, Christianity really was a liberating time for women. The birth of women freedom was born on with Jesus Christ. So Jesus comes into this climate and he talks to the woman at the well. And that was, remember what the Hebrews used to, what the Jewish used to pray? I thank you, God, that I'm not a slave, not a female, and not a Gentile. And Jesus goes and talks to a female Gentile prostitute. That is the lowest of the low of the low on the pecking order. And Jesus goes right there and talks to her, offers her the living water, and he shows her that he is the Messiah and he cares for her. And he is just smashing all kinds of lines. You don't do that. You don't even look at a Gentile woman. And Jesus just blows through it all. And then Paul says in Galatians 3:18 that now there is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male or female, for you are all one in Jesus Christ. So there is neither bond nor free, slave, there's no Jew nor Gentile, male, female, doesn't matter anymore. And all of a sudden, that is a huge mental switch for everyone. I don't know who, I was trying to think, is the mental switch more for the Corinthian men or the Corinthian women? The Corinthian women all went through their lives not being able to do anything, and all of a sudden, they come to Christ, and there's freedom. They are on equal status with the men that they have always been under. And the men need to realize, the Corinthian men, all of a sudden, they're not married to doormats anymore. They need to love their wives. They are called to lay down their lives for their wives. That is not the culture that was there. So this is the church that Paul is writing to. There's some questions. What does this Christian liberty mean? 1 Corinthians 10 was about Christian liberty. What does this liberty mean? What is order? What is church supposed to look like? Men have always dominated every aspect of life. Where does the woman fit in? Where is her place in the pecking order? I mean, she used to be down here. Now all of a sudden she's up here near the top. What's she supposed to do? There's so many questions, and Paul is writing this maybe to check some of the women. Women went from nothing, more or less. Sorry, it doesn't sound good, but that's about where it was. Women went from very low, at least, to equal. And women are preaching in the church. Women are doing all kinds of stuff. And Paul's addressing this now in 11, which we're not gonna go farther into 11. But that's where he's headed. Now, I would like to. Emphasize that God's order right here, the headship order, is not a pecking order. That is not a pecking order. Pecking orders are about establishing dominance. Dominance, dominance. And if you're dominant, you move down. If you're more dominant, you move up. That's how pecking orders work. That is not how God's headship order works. Unfortunately, pecking orders can be how men operate. And it can work that way. And that's not right. But that is not how God's headship order is. God's headship order is an order of love and service. Man is called multiple times to love and serve his wife. He is not called to peck her and keep her down. Even though she is supposed to submit, it's not domineering. You can turn to Ephesians 5. We'll be camped out here for a while. Ephesians 5. For a little bit of context, it's talking about living in the Spirit's power and what you should be doing. Don't be drunk with wine. Instead, be filled with the Spirit, singing hymns and songs. And also, before I read verses 21 to 33, I'd like you to think as I read, does this sound domineering? This is the headship order. This is how God's describing how the order is supposed to work. Does it sound like the woman is being domineered and pushed down and smashed? Is that when you're on the bottom, in my head, when you're on the bottom of a pecking order, which it's not, it's an order. When you're on the bottom of an order, you're below. But that's not what I read here. Ephesians 5, 21 to 33, I might stop a couple places and emphasize some things. Verse 21, submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of the Lord, of God. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands, as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject, submitted, unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, I'm going to stop there for a second. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loves the church and gave himself for it. Christ died for the church. Christ died a death on a cross for the church. And that is how we are supposed to love our wives, with a sacrificial love. We are above, but we are to love her with a sacrificial love. That is not demeaning at all to the woman. Verse 26. So Christ loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. So this kind of verse 28 kind of seems like more of a not secular reason, but less than godly reason to love your wife. Basically, if you love your wife, you're kind of taking care of yourself. That sounds really bad, but I think he said it. You take care of yourself. You're not going to go smashing your hand because it's part of you, and you're not going to go smashing your wife because she's part of you. If you love your wife, it's like loving yourself. Verse 29, no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. For we are members of his body, and of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. So, the husband is called 4 times to love his wife. Love your wife, love your wife, love your wife. And the wife is called to submit maybe twice and reverence her husband. So this is not demeaning. This is, the husband is called to love his wife, love his wife, love his wife. The wife is called to come under the authority of her husband, but he's a good authority to come under. He's a loving authority. The concept of loving your wives sounds perfectly rational to us, but to the Greek Corinthian men, this was as mind-boggling as our culture, the women coming under a man. For our culture, women coming under men and submitting to them, that is mind-boggling. How they're equal, how that is not right. It's mind-boggling to a Corinthian man that I need to love my wife that has always been a doormat. This is very elevating to the woman back then. Women being under authority, the authority of men, is not demeaning. Now we can get so distracted with the order, man over the woman, man over the woman. We can get so distracted that we kind of forget the rest of the order, and we focus on this one because that's what 1 Corinthians 11 is about. But we can't afford to miss the rest of it as well, because man is under authority himself. It is not just woman under man, under man, under man. There's a lot of authority that man is under as well. So I'd like to start at the top of the order and work my way down. The top is God, but Christ is under the authority of God. I'd like to read a couple verses here. Matthew 26:39, and he went a little beyond them. This is Christ in the garden. And he went a little beyond them and fell on his face and prayed, saying, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will. So Christ didn't want to take the cup. The cup was not attractive. It was not good. Well, it was not what he wanted. But he was submitted to the will of the Father because he was under God's authority. And he submitted to that. Not my will, but yours. And John 5:30 says, I can do nothing on my own. I judge as God tells me. Therefore, my judgment is just, because I carry out the will of the one who sent me, not my own will. So Christ was submitted to the Father. Not my own will, but thine. He said that a few times. Submitted. Christ was submitted right here. Christ was submitted to the Father. Now there's another side of it. Christ was submitted to the Father, to God, and God's love poured down on him. It wasn't just submission going one way. There was love going the other way as well. John 5:20 says, "For the Father loveth the Son, and shewed him all things that himself doeth, and he will shew him greater works than these, that ye may marvel." And at the transfiguration, God speaks down about Jesus, saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear him." God loved Jesus. So there is love. There is love here as well. At this level, there is love. Now, there is some distinctions. God and Christ are one, and there is a we'll call it a separation here. This is deity; we are not. Sorry, you can't. A flowchart will break apart somewhere. So there is a difference right in here. Man and women are equal before God, and God and Christ are equal. There is a line right here. That sounds elementary, but you can't. There is some differences right there. So, kind of as a side note, I've said a couple times that women being under the authority of men is not demeaning. I would like to kind of explain in a way that made sense to me. I heard, I was going to give credit to him. I can't remember his name. I heard someone, sorry, bud. I heard someone give the illustration of Jesus and God being the same. So, I don't claim to fully understand the Trinity, but I know that Jesus was fully God and fully man. So that makes Jesus is equal with God. And he did not think equality with God something to be grasped. Jesus was equal to God, and yet Jesus was submitted to God. Jesus was under authority, but that did not make him inferior to God, because Jesus was God. So because Jesus was able to submit to God, that was not saying Jesus was inferior to God, because Jesus is not inferior to God. And in the same way, when women need to submit to men, that does not mean that they are inferior to man. Just because someone submits to someone else does not mean that they are inferior. Just because Jesus submitted to God does not mean that he's inferior. And just because women submits to man does not mean that she's inferior or incapable or less competent. That just means that that's her place in God's order. Jesus understood his place in God's order, and he abided there. And woman is also called to understand her place in God's order and abide there. Not because she is less than man. My wife is just as capable as me as many things. And there are women here that are just as capable as me as being up here preaching. It is not a capability question. It's a God's order question. Okay. Now, man is under Christ. To move on down the list, man is under Christ. James 4:6-7 says, "But he giveth more grace. Wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace to the humble. Submit yourselves therefore to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you." So we are called as mankind. This is arguably man and woman, but for the sake of the drawing, mankind is called to submit. Mankind is called to be submitted to Christ. Christ is Lord over us. It's amazing how many times we use the word submitted without actually saying it. We're called to surrender. We're called to repent. We're called to follow. We're called to be under his lordship. That is all saying we are called to be submitted to Christ and to follow Christ and his leading. That is a calling for man. Man is to be under Christ. And Christ's love flows down on us. Just like it flows down from God to Christ, because Christ was submitted, it flows down from Christ to us, because we were submitted. Maybe I'll backtrack on how I said that. Jesus loves us while we're yet sinners. He does not love us because we are submitted. Jesus' love flows down on us. Maybe I should look and see what I wrote. His headship is not harsh. His headship is not domineering. Just because we are submitted to Christ and he is above us and we obey him does not mean that he is this mean guy on top of us with the pecking order and he is domineering. Jesus says that his yoke is easy and his burden is light. He loves us. He died for us. He gave his life for us. That is the headship that is above us. And that is the model for the man to be. That is what the man is to strive to be. And he's to strive to be like Christ in his relation to the woman who is underneath him in the headship order. This sounds like it's easy. It's certainly not easy to submit to Christ and to be under Christ. But that is not the fault of our head. That is not the fault of the head being faulty. Christ is perfect. The problem is our sinfulness and our lack of submission to be under Christ. Now the woman is also, I believe we said this already, woman is also in the order of authority, not of significance. The woman is also under the man and called to be submitted. And the man is called many, 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 many times to keep loving his wife. The love flows down and down and down through authority, and submitting flows back up. So that is how I see God's headship, how that headship process is supposed to work. It is not just women, you're born this way and you're going to always be last on the totem pole. That is not how it works. So also, I'm gonna take a liberty and add a group to the bottom. This isn't this way in 1 Corinthians, but it is in Ephesians. I'm gonna put children down here. I think that's actually significant. So if you keep on reading Ephesians 5, you get to the end. Ephesians 6 starts with children. I don't think that's coincidental. I think he's including that in the order of authority. I'll read Ephesians 6:1-4. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth. And fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So in verse 1, the children are called to obey. Children are called to submit. Submit to your father and your mother. And then in verse 4, fathers, I don't know why it's not mothers and fathers, but fathers are not to provoke their children. They're to bring them up in the nurture and admonition. So I'm going to call nurture and admonition love. So fathers, this keeps on going right back down to the children. So fathers are called, and mothers, I believe, are called to love their children. I don't know why it doesn't say mothers in there. It might come a little more naturally for them. I don't know. But fathers and mothers are called to nurture and what is the other word? Nurture and admonish their children. So I've been realizing slowly that little boys don't say little boys. I was a school teacher here. I forget, 7 years ago or something. And my fifth graders are graduating. And some of my sixth graders are gone. And I'm realizing that life moves on. And I was just a little boy. I was just in the sandbox not that long ago. And I have a family. But little boys don't say little boys. Little boys grow up. And I was thinking, if a four-year-old isn't submissive to authority, when will he be? If he's not submissive when he's 4, will he be when he's 9? If he's not submissive when he's 9, will he be when he's 17? If he's not submissive when he's 17, will he be when he's 25, 35, 45? Like when does a little boy stop being a little boy? If you don't learn to be submissive to authority, when do you become automatically submissive? Little boys will grow up to be Sunday school teachers, and they'll grow up to be board members, businessmen, preachers. Little boys grow up. And if little boys never learn to be submissive, obey daddy and mommy, obey the church, obey God, if they never learn that, there's going to be some serious problems at a higher level. Sometimes you see little boys that don't like working for daddy, and they can't wait to leave their home because dumb old dad doesn't know what he's talking about. So they leave and go and work for someone, and their boss just doesn't have it together either. And they go, so they quit, and they go to work for another guy, and he doesn't have his head screwed on right either. So they go to the third guy, fourth guy, and then they start to realize it might not actually be my boss's fault. Like maybe I have a problem with submission. Maybe the problem is the young man's lack of submission, and it's not actually everyone else. What about the little girls? Submission is not just for little boys, it's not just for little girls, it's not just for big boys, not just for big girls, it's for everyone. Little girls are going to grow up too. They're going to grow up to be missionaries, teachers, wives, and they're going to grow up to be just as big as the boys. And if they need to know how to submit, if they refuse to submit to their parents, it's not going to magically happen when Prince Charming comes along. Prince Charming comes along and he's way better than my dad. Everything will be great after we get married. Oh, really? That's interesting. If there's no submission to dad, there's going to be some problems with Prince Charming in the future. You cannot forget a childhood without submission. So why was submitting to your father and mother significant enough to make it into the Ten Commandments? It seems kind of like a side note. It doesn't need to be a maybe sixth or so. It doesn't seem like it needs to be on the Ten Commandments, but God put it on the Ten Commandments. This is important because this will wreck society if children are not submissive to their parents. I believe it's one of the, I forget, somewhere it says that one of the signs of the end times will be disobedient children. If you don't learn submission at a young age, if children miss being submissive, we're going to have men that aren't submissive because children grow up to be men and children grow up to be women. We can kind of forget that, but unsubmissive children will grow up to be unsubmissive men, and they're going to be hard to get under. It's hard for a woman to get under a man that doesn't listen to anybody. Why should I listen to you if you don't listen to anybody? What tell your daughter you need to do this? Well, why do I need to listen to you if you don't listen to anybody else? It can be a nasty, nasty cycle. So now I have two more thoughts on headship. They didn't fit nicely into my outline, so here they are. Headship is not just a women's issue. Submission to authority is just as much of an issue for men as it is to women. Women are called to stay in their spot, but so are men. And men have a hard time staying under Christ. I want to do what I want to do. I don't want to listen. And if we don't think that the men have to listen, how can we expect the women to listen to God's order? If we're leading our families and we are not leading submitted to Christ, it's not going to end well for anybody. The order breaks down. Not saying that a woman can't be submissive to a man that's not following Christ. I think they can, but it becomes a whole lot tougher. So men are under Christ and are called to lead like Christ. I think I said this already, but we are called to lead with a servant attitude, laying down our lives for our wives. Imagine a little boy says to his sister after a headship sermon like this, "Ha-ha, I'm above you. I just heard a preacher said, man, woman, I'm going to be a man, you're a woman, I'm above you." Hey, bud. Also, what he should be saying is, "Ha-ha, since I will be a man, I'll take responsibility for my family, support them, make the hard decisions, discipline my children, and lay down my life in servanthood for my family." That's what he really should be saying. Being a man, being an authority, doesn't sound so glowing when you put it that way. There is responsibility that comes with authority. But when you get your license and you have the authority to take a car on the road, there is some responsibility that comes with that. You wreck it, you buy it. You speed, you pay the fine. There is some responsibility that comes with that authority. Not only is man still under his authority, he is still under Christ, but he needs to lead with wisdom and servanthood. Being a man is, I'm realizing, not just a default, I'm good at it. There needs to be servanthood, and there needs to be submission to the authorities above you. When men don't learn to be submissive, when they aren't submissive at church, aren't submissive to civil authorities, to Christ, or to their bosses at work, huge problems happen. Church splits happen because men aren't submissive, and I'm not listening to you. You have the brotherhood has no say on me because I'm above that. I'm following Christ, and that is it. There's some problems that come with that. What about tax evasion. I'm not submitted to the civil authorities. What I give for my taxes is fine. Tax evasion happens if you're not submitted. What about apostasy? I'm not submitted to Christ. I don't need that. I'm good. I'll just live a good life. And he fall away because he wasn't submitted. Men get fired from their jobs at work. That's something tangible we can see. I'm not going to listen to you. You might be my boss, but you just saw my paychecks. I'm not going to listen to you. And you get fired. That's not how it works. You need to be submitted to the order. When men in authority, husbands, church leaders, businessmen, whatever, when they are not submitted to their authority, problems happen. That's the source of many problems. I've heard Frank Reed say a couple times that men are the source of most of the problems in the world, and they're also the answer to most of the problems in the world. And I can back that up. That's true. So my second point that has no order is, what is a woman supposed to do who has obvious leadership qualities or teaching qualities? So what do you do? What do you do if you're born a woman and you have teaching qualities, you're born to lead? What do? Just kind of shrivel up in a corner and, you know, this is where God put me, wah, poor me? Like, what are you supposed to do? Is there a place for you to use your gifts? And there are women in our church that are gifted and that could probably do a better job up here than me, and that's okay. But older women, there are places for women to use their gifts, and there are women mentioned in the Bible. Women are not just this, Ananias and Sapphira. You know, she just tagged along. No, women actually had a purpose. Older women are commanded to teach the younger women. Titus 2:4-8. I guess we can turn there. I wasn't going to. Titus, Philemon, Philippians 2. The aged women likewise, that they be in behavior as becoming holiness, not false accusers, not given much wine, teachers of good things, that they may teach the younger women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. So older women do have a calling. They are to teach the younger women. If you want to teach, there's opportunity. Women's Sunday school, Bible study. There is avenues that women can use their leadership qualities and use teaching qualities to build God's kingdom. Also, it can be overlooked. Women teach the next generation. The children won't stay small. There's probably a preacher here that's little right now. There's probably a deacon here that's little right now. It's kind of weird to think about, but in our church, there probably is. You are called to lead them. Now, daddy does his job too, but daddy's not actually there a lot. It is good that women should have leadership capabilities, because when I leave for work at 7:30, the reins are handed over to my wife. I might be a phone call away, but the reins are handed over to my wife. She needs some leadership capabilities. If she wants to go to Walmart, she needs some leadership capabilities. If you want to survive, you need leadership capabilities. It's not a bad thing to have leadership capabilities. If you're going to be single, a woman who's single needs leadership capabilities to survive. A woman that is married needs leadership capabilities to run a house, because daddy's not there all the time. Someone needs to run it. It's not going to work without that. So women have been influential in the church. Adam came across a list. This is not exhaustive. Rhoda, Eunice, Lois, Lydia, Priscilla, and the list goes on for a while, but there were lots of women that are mentioned in the New Testament that were significant, that were encouraging, and that were doing a lot. One of the things that I never thought about, but I came across when I was studying, was that women were praying and prophesying in the Corinthian church, in church. 1 Corinthians 11:5, usually we read this thinking about her head should be covered. But every woman that prayeth or prophesieth with her head uncovered dishonoreth her head, for that is even all one as if she were shaven. So the fact is, they were praying and prophesying just with uncovered heads. Like, they were praying and prophesying in church. But that also needs to be heard along with 1 Corinthians 14. So there was praying and prophesying going on in the church by women. But in 1 Corinthians 14, 34 to 35, says, in the NLT, it's pretty blatant. Women should be silent during the church meetings. It is not proper for them to speak. They should be submissive, just as the law says. If they have any questions, they should ask their husbands at home, for it is improper for women to speak in church meetings. Well, how do you reconcile those two passages? Women were preaching and preaching. Women were speaking, prophesying, and praying. There we go. Praying and prophesying. And now, two chapters later, they're told to be silent. How do you explain that? So I personally do believe that women can take part in the service. Women can pray. Women can, in sharing time, women can say, this is what God has been doing in my life. This is how I've seen God work. I think that's appropriate. I think that's fine. Women can pray. At prayer meeting, women, it's okay if they pray. But I think the line needs to be drawn when women are teaching men. If women are preaching, men are coming under her. If we have a female preacher, men are coming under the woman's authority. And I think that is not just because Paul says blatantly here that women should be silent in church meetings, not just because of that, but because it violates God's headship order. Man is not supposed to be submitted to the woman underneath her preaching. Man is supposed to, in love, lead. Emphasis in love. This is not women, get back down there. No, this is men need to take their place. It's easy for men not to take their place. Men don't even want to lead sometimes. It's easy for men to say, hey, you make that decision around the house. Look, I know it's my job, but do whatever you want. I don't care. I want to read my book. And men can take a back seat pretty quick, but men are called to lead. And that is violated when women are leading, and women are leading the church. And I believe that is God's call is not, God's heart is not to put down women and get out of here. God's call is to raise men up, to be men that lead with love. That is how he designed it. When he made Adam and Eve, he made Adam first and gave him a helpmate. Eve was his helpmate. He made him a helper and made Adam the leader. That's how he designed it. I didn't design that. I didn't write this book. But God, that is God's design. So, to conclude, our God is a God of order, and he did make it. This is how it works, and this is how he designed it, and it is good. It is not good because I say it is. It is good because God made it. It's not a pecking order. It's not a men are middle of the pecking order because they're bigger, better, stronger. We're kind of dumb sometimes, and women are, my wife's smarter than me probably. It's not a pecking order. Women have a purpose, and men have a purpose as well. That is what the headship veiling is about. Why do you wear the thing on the head? Just because our church tells me to. 1 Corinthians 11. It also says that I am taking my place in God's plan of authority for my life, and God says that I am supposed to be under authority, and I embrace that, and I obey, and I submit myself to something I don't even really want to do. I don't want to wear this thing on my head, but I submit myself to God's plan. That is what women veiling their heads is about. That's the deeper why behind why we do it. This is not a henpecked demeaning, I'm down here because God says so. This is a accepting your place in God's plan. Did I bring it? I thought I did. Okay. Well, the Mennonite Confession of Faith says it pretty well. I was sure I brought that. Do I have the Mennonite Confession of Faith right there? No? It's gone. All right. Well, it says, I'll try and try and quote it. Basically, the headship order doesn't limit the freedom of women and put them in a box where you need to serve here. Instead, the headship order emphasizes that God made an order that is best. And that is his order of the women under the man enables the women to live out in the place that she does best. The man is built to lead. Women are built to nurture and to help and to raise families, and men are called to raise families too. But the headship order shows the right path to where women and men can both most fruitfully serve. It says it better than that, but that's my general conclusion. It's not good when you lose your conclusion, but I'd like to call for a song.